This is the Car Dealer Podcast driven by CarGurus. You want the best return for your advertising budgets, and CarGurus piston heads are focused on the same goal. With them, you have access to millions of monthly shoppers across both sites. Connect with in-market high-quality buyers today and turbocharge your digital forecourt. For more information, visit dealerpackages.cargurus.co.uk and schedule a demo with their team. That's dealerpackages.cargurus.co.uk and tell them we sent you.
Welcome back to the Car Dealer Podcast. If you haven't listened before, we pick our favourite stories of the week and ask an industry guest to choose which were the best. I'm John Ray, and joining me this week is a customer service expert, a man who once sent back a coffee in a restaurant because it was too hot. It's James Baggett.
I'm never, ever going to live that down, am I?
No. Excuse me. This coffee is too hot.
John, it was too hot. Take it away. It was generally too hot.
And the poor, this is in Cardiff, poor Welsh waitress, probably about 16, had no idea what was going on and how possibly a coffee could be too hot unless it was literally evaporating from the cup. So I think she just took it away, put it on a shelf somewhere, and then brought it back 5 minutes later when it was not too hot.
Perfect.
You know what, John? I would have to agree with James there. It should be at 85 degrees or less.
Thank you. Thank you, Neil. You can come back.
Never make a cup of coffee with boiling water. It destroys the plate. Anyway, that's enough.
Well, James maintains this day that the milk was burnt, which it wasn't. But anyway, I'll come to you in a minute, Neil, but I will just...
Thank you. Yeah, sorry for interrupting.
No, that's absolutely fine.
No. Thank you for backing me up, Neil. It's much appreciated.
Yeah, I can see he's going to win this already. So, James, how has your week been?
It's been brilliant, thank you, John. It's been very hot, which has been nice after many months of cold. And we've been out and about filming for our Car Dealer Power Awards, which is coming up on June the 28th. We were at the winning manufacturer's head office on Wednesday filming the studio stuff, which was, I can't give too much away, but it was an amazing head office. And yesterday, Thursday, we filmed the winning cars, which I can't mention what they are, so this is a little bit boring, but yeah. It was nice to get out and about and do some filming and get away from my little box room and actually do some stuff with some vehicles for once.
Yes, it has been nice, hasn't it?
Yes. How's your week been, John? We're going to have to go into your journey from Kettering to Gosport on Tuesday, which was quite possibly you probably could
don't
have
switch off, quicker. Listeners.
Yeah, you could have walked here quicker though, couldn't you?
Yeah.
Summarize it.
Well, I set off at a very sprightly time of 6:20 in the morning. I got 20 miles down the road and then hit something, and my tire exploded. And then it took 4 hours for anyone to come and rescue me from the side of the A43 in Toaster. Unfortunately, not actually near Toaster, because I could have walked to Waitrose, which would have been very nice. But yes, so a lot of that. Of course, nobody has any tyres anywhere in a particular size for my lovely Mazda. So there was a lot of ringing around at 8:30. Do you have a tyre? No, I can get one in 2 weeks. Okay, great. Do you have a tyre? No, I can get one in 2 weeks. Okay, great. So then eventually a tow truck did arrive after a lot of badgering on the phone. I must have phoned people about 20 times trying to say, no, there is no point in sending a man to try and show me how to use the inflator. It will not inflate. There is a hole in the side of the tire an inch wide. It will not inflate. Unless you have magic healing hands, you will not be able to fix this tire. Please send a low loader. Well, now, unfortunately, we have to send out a technician first, but there are things the technicians can do. What? What can you do? What can you do with that? It doesn't have a spare. Do you have a spare?
This has really bothered you, John, can't you?
So much of that. Anyway, eventually, yeah, a man turned up with a low loader and took me 10 miles north of my house, which is basically further away than when I started from at 6 o'clock in the morning. So that was good. And then I was supposed to have a nice courtesy car. That didn't work, as in like a hire car from the recovery company. They phoned Enterprise and said, oh, yeah, Enterprise will have a car for you. Enterprise did not have a car for me. So then they offered me a van 20 miles away from where I actually was, which was not really ideal. So I got on the train, and then the train broke with no air conditioning. So I was quite hot and bothered by the time I arrived.
You're listening to Therapy with John Ray.
Oh, my God. What I basically learned, my learnings from all this, is that there are no joined up systems anywhere in, like, whenever you phone a breakdown recovery thing, all of this stuff is all, like, so completely disconnected. I phoned two different recovery companies. The AA never turned up. It took 4 hours. They never turned up. The one that did was the Mazda thing, because it's a new Mazda. But the stupid Mazda thing sends you a link to say where you are. So you do a pinpoint on a map and it knows where you are by GPS and whatever on your phone. But if you're in a lay-by by the A43, as I am, it won't let you select that because it doesn't have a postcode. So I was there like, I'm here. Just show me I'm here. Wouldn't do it. Had to phone someone. They put a postcode of somewhere in Toaster. That was not where I was. Then had three phone calls to explain to the recovery company why I was not in Toaster. So it's all gone really well. All gone brilliantly. Don't get a flat tire ever.
It was a lot easier when you used to carry a spare, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Yeah. Yes, it was. I'm going to drive over in my 20-year-old Subaru now with its Space Saver, which I've used about 5 times. That's a much better idea.
Anyway.
After that, John, I can probably safely say that the hot coffee discussion was a little bit more interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's all we've got time for this week. If you've got any tips on how to...
Quick, move on, John.
Well, I'm going to introduce our guest. He is an automotive retail consultant and former Cazoo and Imperial Cars director. It's Neil Smith. Hello, Neil.
Hello, John. Hi, James.
Hello, Neil. Thank you for joining us. Sorry you had to listen to those two incredibly boring stories. We will get onto some interesting stuff. Anyway, what have you been up to since Cazoo days, Imperial days? What have you been doing?
So exited Cazoo in November 2020. Took about 2-3 months to decide what the next part of that career journey was going to look like. Ended up getting a few requests for consultation through LinkedIn and the network that I've built up over those years. So set up my own consultancy in, it would have been end of February now, 2021. From that point on, a lot of variety in what I do. So dealing with dealers, informing, helping, advising, but across independent franchise space. Looking at supplier offerings, new startups, and advising them from the dealer proposition point of view, and you know how they should be presenting that and what they need to deliver. Working in the lender space, working in the DMS space, got a contract over in, of all places, Baltic States. I'd never been there before, didn't even know what the Baltic States consisted of until I started working with these guys. So I'm out there once every 6 weeks. Again, largest used car retailer in Baltic States, which covers Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. Just opened a branch in Poland as well, which is exciting. We've opened some retail shops in shopping centres there, which was something I was always keen to do in the Imperial days, but we never got the chance to do that. Inform and advise them across the whole piece from preparation. They've got a unique buying service to buy. Everything they buy is from outside of the Baltic States. They've got a buying division set up in Rotterdam, and they source everything. Really, it's all ex-main dealer stock from Belgium, Holland, that sort of thing, and then ship it in. So good quality stuff. So really exciting stuff dealing with those guys. And if you look at where they are as a business in terms of their digital footprint and their digital technology, they developed that all themselves, much as we did in Imperial. And I'd probably put those guys in the top 5% of what we see in the UK now in terms of used car retailing. So very, very advanced in a sector that traditionally, if you bought a used car from a true independent there, you're expecting it to be mileage adjusted and you're expecting to get no after sale. So they've really gone the whole distance on the openness, transparency, putting everything online, supporting the consumer, providing warranties, that sort of thing. So yeah, in a nutshell, and probably almost as boring as John's story, that's what I've been doing.
Only if you talk about flying out there and getting delayed, or you know, that's the level.
I'm not going down that one.
Neil, the European market is quite different, isn't it, to the UK? And obviously, you had a lot of experience running businesses here. What have you learned anything over there that they do differently, or has it been taking stuff from here to them and teaching them to do stuff the way we do it?
So I think certainly the experience with Longer Group, which is the business in the Baltic States, And let's probably just rewind a little bit to how that business was set up. So the business was set up 5 years ago by two Bain & Co. consultants, so sort of McKinsey-level consultants. Two guys, one Latvian, one Dutch, had been working together, met each other at Bain & Co., had worked for, back in the past for businesses like Nokia and businesses in Russia and businesses in Holland, across Europe, really. And they just decided at a point that they wanted to do something for themselves. They had no used car, no retail car experience at all. They looked across all the markets in Europe and looked at all of the lots of different industries, and then alighted and landed on used car retailing, independent used car retailing, and saw that there was definitely a gap within the Baltic states for a trusted, transparent, digitally enabled business. So they have spun that business up, developing their own tech, as I said. So everything they do is self-developed. They're not plugging into any sort of third-party applications. Their website's self-developed and links 100% with the BI business information system. So they were doing stuff when I joined them 2 years ago, which was probably, even then, was in advance of, I would say, 90% of the UK independents. So they had a pretty idea. They were very good because of their background of researching across Europe, understanding what the different models were, and then implementing that in the Baltic states, which was a massive step up in what those consumers across those regions were used to. What they've done, where I come into play, is that, and they set up a centralized preparation center in Lithuania a couple of years ago when I first started working with them. So I was able to advise across that piece, and we've started to we've continually improved that. They prepare cars to a very high standard for those regions. You know, they're selling cars between 100 and 150,000 kilometers on the clock, so older vehicles, but they still prepare to a very good standard, and they'll warrant them as well. It's a 2-month warranty they provide on those. So they were doing some really good stuff. What they needed was someone to come in with experience that would say, yeah, actually, you're doing the right thing, or here, you probably need to tweak it. Look at the way you're handling your customer contact. Look at the way you're handling your customer journey. Start to offer extended warranties, because that wasn't something they were doing. You know, protect yourself, protect the customer, generate some more revenue. Look at that finance penetration piece. So where I was able to come in initially was to sort of ratify what they were doing, add value where I could. And then we've gone on this continuous path of improvement, and we've looked at, okay, how can we open up our reach? And that's where we've opened up the shops, one in a high-end shopping mall in Lithuania and one in Estonia. So sort of pushing the envelope again and saying, right, okay, we need to generate awareness. How can we do this? Traditionally as well, the marketing over there is very different. So they haven't got one dominant player in the aggregator space like we have here. So what they are doing is leveraging the likes of Facebook, and they do really well out of Facebook. You know, because of their reputation, their reviews, their customer experience, their customer service levels, and what they and how they present everything, they get fantastic feedback on Facebook, and they generate a hell of a lot of sales through Facebook, which is unusual when you compare with the UK market. So that's a great channel for them. AdWords, paid search, that's a great channel. They dabble in aggregator, but very low level. So of a, you know, if we look at €100,000 marketing spend a month, probably about 10K of that is spent on aggregator. The rest is spread across those other two channels. Areas we're developing now with those guys is the PR piece. They're around about 2% of the market in those regions at the moment. They're now spinning up the PR campaigns and looking at maybe a couple more traditional channels like radio and a bit of TV over there to start to really build the brand. Typically, the biggest difference, I suppose, is the buying. You know, they are sourcing externally, and then they'll be transporting vehicles 600, 700,000 miles to the prep center.
And that's still cost effective to do, is it then, to drag them all the way from Belgium and so on?
Yeah, it is. They've got a phenomenal sourcing operation. They've got a phenomenal team working in Rotterdam sourcing those cars that have built up some great relationships. They buy nothing from auction, so it is all bought through franchise dealer networks. They built up their reputation, and they built, so they will deal with known dealers who get great stock in, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 year old stock. They will commit to a price. They'll buy the car at the price. again, you know, so many dealers, so many buyers will not do what they do. And there are certain benefits to buying in Holland that I think it's premium luxury tax. So on premium vehicles, there is a luxury tax that is applied at the point of sale. And if you export that vehicle, you at a point, and depending on age, you can claim that luxury tax back. Now, that means they are able to buy these cars, but it's a very onerous, long-winded operation, and you've only got, I think, something like 48 hours to claim that tax back. They've set up the operation to be able to do that seamlessly and efficiently. So there's an additional benefit on some of those vehicles that they derive there. But because they're very good at sourcing and they're very good at buying at the right price, they are retaining, even with those transport costs, really good margins. You know, their margins are in excess of a lot of dealers at the level they're dealing in the UK in terms of their profitability in the middle.
Neil, you obviously had a fantastic career in the UK retail industry. You're now doing something quite different. Do you miss selling cars? I'm very surprised you haven't popped back up in your own dealership or in somebody else's.
Look, I had opportunities at the exit point at Cazoo. Obviously, I spoke to a lot of people. I had a great network of people and people I'd known for years, and there were opportunities there. For me, I suppose I am, and I say this a lot, I am a lot happier now on the outside looking in rather than on the inside looking out.
Really?
You know, Imperial Cars was fantastic, real roller coaster. Cazoo, learned a lot. Learned a lot in a very short space of time about that sort of model. However, it was stressful when you're at the volume level and you're trying to achieve a... Certainly, as we accelerated Imperial, there were some great times and we had some great successes. But there are also times when you know you've got to hit this number month in, month out, and you've got to get your warranty pen at 50% and your finance pen at 45%. Otherwise, the business doesn't make money. Mm. We've got to be able to source 3,000 cars a month. We've got to be able to sell 2,200 cars a month, you know. Nailing down ROAS on all your marketing and nailing down the return on investment and the cost per lead and the cost per sale and making sure your sales teams are doing everything they need to do to optimize that conversion. And yeah, it becomes a real beast. Yeah, at the end of the piece with Imperial, we employed 650 people. We had 17 sites. You know, we could not be at every site every day, watching, monitoring, managing, making sure everybody was logged, et cetera, et cetera. So we had to develop lots of technology to help us do that to the best of our ability. Technology that at the time, 2015, 16, 17, wasn't available in the sort of volume it is now. You know, there are loads of certainly in the last 3 to 4 years, and I deal with a lot of these guys, there are lots of really good SaaS-based products that have been released at very low cost, really, that can plug into dealers' operations now, that can do a lot of what we had to go and develop ourselves back in the day. And look, there are DMSs out there that just don't deliver on a volume used car retailer front what they need to deliver. They're great for franchise operations. They're great for dealer networks and OEMs, but we had one of those DMSs. We had to develop our own DMS effectively behind that to work day to day, to be able to operate as dynamically as we needed to be able to buy in bulk. You know, there's nothing off the shelf out there unless you plug in lots of different SaaS-based platforms, which can work, and you develop an ecosystem which allows you to function effectively at a real volume level in used car retailing. So, yeah, look, I think, you know, going back to the original questions, I suppose, yes, there are days I miss it, but actually I've got a lot of variety now. I've got a lot of flexibility. My work-life balance is so much better because I dictate what I do when I do and what I want to do. But there are times I miss it. I miss the buzz. You know, when you're in that sort of operation, there is a real buzz when it's flying. But there's a level of pressure that comes with it. And that's what I don't miss.
You're one of the few people that have been on the inside of Cazoo, and I wouldn't be doing my job properly if I didn't ask you some questions on that front. So I'm sure you can expect them coming. Where have they gone wrong, Neil, since you've left?
Well, that's it. We've left.
Obviously, I left, James. No, it's not at all. Not at all. No, look. I'll be quite open and frank. I mean, the model is still so that model of retailing is still attractive to a percentage of buyers. You know, so let's take all the issues that have occurred over the last 2.5 years. Let's forget about the fact that obviously investors over this period, and it's not just Cazoo, so let's highlight that, Kavana have gone through, went through exactly the same decline in the States, and the Cazoo model was very much the same as the Kavana model. So for whatever reason, there was a market swing and a change in investors' appetite for that sort of model, and that's why we saw massive depreciation in the value of those businesses. The model from a consumer perspective works, irrespective of Cazoo, irrespective of Kavana, irrespective of Cinch, and how much money they've ploughed in to get those people at the top of the funnel to deliver that final number at the bottom. Cazoo will deliver 60,000 vehicles this year. Cinch, not certain, but similar or more. Now, put those two together, that represents over between 1% and 2% of the total sales volume in the UK for used vehicles. So the model is attractive to a subset of consumers, and that works. And for any company, and again, put aside all the investment and the spend that was put into marketing, for any company to start under 4 years ago and spin up sales to 60,000 used vehicles, that's pretty impressive. But it has been supported by massive spend and massive investment in marketing, and obviously development in the tech, and making sure that online experience is as slick and efficient as possible. Where have they gone wrong? They were never going to change the model that they started with, and I don't think they ever will, because that was the model that was sold to the investors, and it was the model that was the disruption to the market. And look, it does make me laugh a little bit when I see comments over the last few months around, you know, some of the main dealer groups saying we're now disrupting the disruptors. Well, the fact of the matter is, if Cazoo and Cinch hadn't done what they'd done back in 2019, moving through into COVID, none of us thought we would ever want to be able to sell a vehicle fully online and have to suffer the potential for it to be just returned to us within 7 days, 14 days, because someone just didn't like the car, you know? None of us put our head over the parapet. We were probably one of the closer ones in the used car sector. We did a lot of work coming up to COVID around, could we sort of spin this up? And that, again, that was only because we had insight into what Cazoo were doing. And we thought, well, okay, you know, if they're coming to market with this proposition, we need to at least offer this proposition, not make it the whole proposition, because that hybrid model, that omni-channel solution is definitely the way forward. But let's not close off a percentage of those consumers, those digital adopters that actually would like to buy a car that way. Let's just add that to our mix, you know. So
were you banging that drum when you were in Cazoo about the fact that the physical and digital is what's needed? Because that's, I mean, that from the outside looking in, that's the one thing that they never did with those imperial sites that they had, and they actually that could have made them a very strong proposition.
Yeah, look, we got taken into the business. I had a remit there, which was to get the sites converted from the imperial sales sites to Cazoo collection centers. We had discussions across all departments there, James. You know, we were involved in discussions. We were given our view. We were told what the Cazoo view was. You know. Yeah, I mean, our background meant that there were times when we were discussing, you know, what's the potential for looking at these sites and utilizing what those sites are capable of. But as I said previously, the model was certainly, back then, there was no moving on that model, because that was the disruptor model. It was about taking a percentage of the market, and those consumers, the digital adopters who were happy to deal that way, and putting them fully down that online piece. So I think we would have ended up, and probably at times did end up, just banging our head on a wall there, because and that wasn't because, that's not because there was an arrogance there. That was because they firmly believed that they could hit the numbers that they wanted to hit using the model they had. And even if you look at their 5-year projections originally, which I think was around about 240,000 units in year five, that would still have only been a 3-4% market share. Now, I remember, James, and I got pulled on this about 2 months ago by a dealer group owner who I bumped into at a podcast. I remember saying on the podcast or the piece I did with you probably a year and a bit ago outside the old Imperial site, I said, don't underestimate Cazoo. So, yeah, I got pulled on that. I walked into another podcast and you're the guy who said, don't underestimate Cazoo. Look at them now. And I was thinking, okay, right, let's just address that. Yeah, the fact is, it's not going well, You know, market forces have delivered a real blow there. And again, it's not just Cazoo, but just focus on the fact they're still going to deliver a number of units. Now, this is putting aside the story you ran a few weeks ago around financial irregularities and various other challenges they've got at the moment. So assuming that all you know, they get through that, then they are going to deliver a volume. But I also said in that piece to you, and I remember, but you shouldn't be focusing on, just keep a watching brief. You know, at the end of the day, even if they hit their numbers, they're still only looking at 2 to 3% market share. So as long as everybody else is doing what they need to do from an omni-channel perspective, there's enough there for everybody. So, we obviously had discussions around that omni-channel piece, but it was clear that wasn't the model that was going to be introduced at the time.
It's just that I think for me, it's the fact that they launched on the stock market to such a high valuation, you know, six billion at the time. They were promising to disrupt not only the UK, but all of Europe. They did this massive expansion by buying loads of different businesses. And they've just rode back on that constantly since. So what is now, what you could really describe as quite, you know, an average sized car dealership and car dealership, then I honestly don't think they're ever going to be able to get back to those sorts of valuations they had before. Their market cap the last time I looked at them was 40 odd million pounds. I mean, you compare that to the market cap of Motorpoint at the moment, 108 million pounds, gives you some sort of idea, doesn't it, of where they sit in the market. What they massively overpromised and have hugely under delivered. Do you think they're going to be able to survive?
Look, that's in the lap of the gods. However, what they have done is they have not been shy in making sweeping changes. Now, obviously, for me, that's, you know, the redundancies and that have not been good news, especially as I still had a lot of ex-colleagues that were working there, you know, and they're still under threat. I think what they've done now, though, by pulling in traditional expert used car retailers at the top of that tree, i.e. Jonathan, and starting to turn around that GPU, and obviously Jonathan's adding value across that piece. They made mistakes. No one can deny that. You know, I don't think anybody could have forecast the sort of lack of or that complete 180 turn in the lack of confidence in that model. And again, not just Cazoo, because Carvana experienced exactly the same. And they had been on, Carvana had been on a growth spurt for 7 years, going to 51 billion market cap, dropping to exactly the same sort of level of percentage drop. And when you look at that, there wasn't any real, I couldn't see, and you may have some insight on that, I couldn't see any real reason why that happened. I don't know why that happened in the States, in the UK. I don't know why suddenly it fell at such a rapid rate. It wasn't as though volume-wise either of those models were.
It came at a time people lost confidence in these businesses, the tech businesses that just weren't making a profit and had no obvious route to profitability. And I think they're just and at the same time, investor confidence in the car market in general has fallen. So I think it fell drastically.
I think it was the perfect storm. And you're right, you know, let's move it outside of automotive. Uber have never made any money and make huge losses. Deliveroo, Just Eat, all of these businesses that are spinning up on the back of massive investment. None of those businesses have made any money at all. They're making huge losses. So,
let me ask you one last question on this before we actually move onto our news quiz. But
yes,
did you have much dealings with Alex Chesterman, and what was he like as a person?
I didn't have an awful lot of dealing with Alex, if I'm honest. Most of what, you know, where I dealt was with the C-suite. So sort of worked across the C-suite there. Obviously had a couple of chats with him. Look, as a person, he's a nice guy. You know, what you saw portrayed online was not what you saw when talking to him.
I think James is asking for email intro there.
I don't think Alex wants to.
Can we get him on?
Yeah.
He'd love to hear nice stories about
that. You know, so look, the whole the whole sort of PR piece at the beginning of that kazoo journey was stage managed to obviously deliver the messaging they wanted across the industry. Mm-hmm. That didn't help, obviously didn't help the perception of kazoo in the eyes of the rest of the automotive dealer network. But hey, yeah, I can't really speak to, you know, let's put it this way. I never went out for dinner with him or did it like that. But, look, the interactions I had with Alex, albeit that very, very light, were all fine. So, and look, same for the rest of the team. You know, they were there to do a job. Ultimately, now they've realised they need, you know, further down the line, they've realised they need that used car experience and need some advice and some insight and some input there, which is why they've gone with Jonathan there. So, who knows, James? Who knows? You know, I would never have seen what's happened in the last 12 months and never have foreseen that at all, either within kazoo or across the whole automotive space. You're right, Motorpoint are valued at 108 million market cap. I'm sure we might talk about that story in a minute, where they've seen massive swings in profit year on year. But yeah, probably best to leave it there with kazoo.
I will ask question. I will ask one more question, only because I drove past the Newport Pagnell ex-Kazoo site yesterday. And
John, this wasn't on your long protracted journey the other
day. No, it wasn't. It wasn't. Okay. Luckily, it was later on. But it's just kind of, it's just left there with all the furniture still in it. The Kazoo branding has been ripped off. It's just like abandoned. I mean, is it frustrating for you to see the sites that you set up, you know, in Imperial Cars Day when it was all really rosy and you were making decent money, just mothballed like this? And I mean, some have obviously been turned into like the Snow's used car center in Southampton.
Yes.
But there's quite a few, I imagine, that have not been reused yet.
Yeah. And look at this. I mean, look, we, prior to COVID at Imperial, we had a plan, and our plan was to get to 30 sites nationwide. Okay. We were on site number 18 and we had just acquired Manchester. So we reckoned we had about another 2 or 3 years to realize that plan. At that point, you know, we would have been looking to maybe flip the business or work out where we were going next with that business. So, and the whole point was to have sites within 50-mile radius of each other so that we could cover every potential opportunity for consumers across the UK, Scotland and Wales. So that was the plan. And we took a lot of time and effort in finding the right sites and checking out the chimney pots around the sites and making sure everything is working and spinning those sites up as quickly as possible. So it is, you know, I'm sure if I drove past Newport Pagnell and saw it was just standing empty now. And it's not just that. It's the people that were involved in those sites, the people we employed for those sites, how we, you know, not wanting to get too sort of melancholy. The fact of the matter is you employ people, you give them an ability to earn good money and you give them the ability to have a good lifestyle. And now we see a lot of those sites closed or shut. It's disappointing. And it was disappointing at the point that, you know, we went through the acquisition piece that we were not able to continue the journey. You know, we would like to have continued that journey. But COVID hit pretty hard on Imperial. We made money. There were years we didn't make great money because we were pushing it all back into the business and accelerating. And that was the mentality of the business was to keep growing, open 3 or 4 sites a year if we could, and keep expanding that footprint. So, probably to close it down, Imperial was a great, great time. Roller coaster ride. We had some great ambition, weren't able to realize it. Kazoo was a great experience. Learned a lot from that in terms of a different model. And whether it's Kazoo or Cinch or a lot of the retailers now that have spun up these online delivery models as in addition to their standard traditional physical model, you know, there's still value in that. And I learned a lot from that. But going back to the original question, probably happier doing what I'm doing now than being back into that space.
Sounds a little bit less stressful these days.
definitely.
We'll be right back. You want the best return from your advertising budget, and CarGurus Piston Heads are focused on the same goal. With them, you have access to millions of monthly shoppers across both sites. Connect with in-market, high-quality buyers today and turbocharge your digital forecourt. For more information, visit dealerpackages.cargurus.co.uk and schedule a demo with their team. That's dealerpackages.cargurus.co.uk and tell them we sent you. Now, let's get back to the quiz.
Let's give poor Neil a rest.
Yes, yeah. So I'm not going to do the intro of how this works because everyone knows, but I am going to say I won last week again, so I'm going to go for the first story. And it is a wide-ranging interview with Mercedes-Benz UK CEO Gary Savage. And this is an interview carried out by Jim Holder, a name people will recognise from Autocar and What Car and various other publications in the Haymarket playbook. But this is a wide-ranging interview, largely around their introduction of the agency model. So there's some interesting points in here. He kind of hits back at criticism a little bit. So Gary says they introduced the agency model in response to requests from dealers to boost new car profits. So as far as he's concerned, his dealers were asking for this model, which is an interesting thing to hear. He also says, unsurprisingly, customers like the model because they've given it a satisfaction rating of 4.7 out of 5. So that sort of backs that up. But he also says dealers like the model. And he's been on the road talking to lots of dealers, and he's had nothing but positive feedback. He says it's a lot more straightforward for administrators who are doing all the paperwork and all this sort of stuff because the process is more streamlined. And salespeople like it as well because customers can't halfway through the deal suddenly go, oh, I've just seen this one at this price from a broker. Can you match this particular price? Interesting. He doesn't like the term fixed prices, though, which is we're struggling to know what to call this whole thing, aren't we, James? It's back and forth between, do we call it agency? Do we call it fixed prices?
Well, I think the best way of describing it is I've sort of flipped to fixed price, no haggle sales, because nobody knows what agency means. And as much as he does say, it's not fixed price, it absolutely is fixed.
Well, it is, that's right, it's fixed price across the country. He doesn't like that it's called fixed price because he says there are nationwide offers with price cuts, you know,
not like, are all exactly the same.
I know, it's like saying curry's done with fixed prices, isn't it?
I'm pretty certain the advert that Mercedes have put out on this actually mentions it right at the end, and it's a fixed price. I'm sure that's the Mercedes advert.
Well, clearly he's not watching the telly much at the minute. He does also say not to judge it all yet, but that the signs are positive and the metrics are getting better month by month. Mm. So lots of interesting things in here, James. I'm sure you have a lot to say.
I thought this, firstly, fantastic interview from Jim Holder, who's now freelance and is writing for us. So thank you to Jim for putting this piece together. I mean, firstly, I'd say fair play to Mercedes, to Gary Savage. We were putting this feature together. Jim and I were talking about it a lot. I said we need to go to Mercedes and get their side of the story and ask for a comment, as is the norm in these pieces. Jim went there, and instead of just sending over a couple of paragraphs, they said, "Do you want to chat to Gary?" and gave Jim a half an hour sit down interview with Gary, where he could put his side of the story across. So fair play to them for doing that, firstly. Mm-hmm. And that's why we've run both these pieces. They're on the website today, Friday. You can read the full Q&A. You can read it in full and all of his answers. But Jim's also summarized it, as you've clearly said. I mean, my standout point in this is one that you mentioned, and his quote was, "Remember, the networks came to us and said, we need to stem the decline in profitability. Agency was the answer to their provocation," was what Gary Savage said. So funny, I asked a few dealers after they'd read this story what they thought of that, and they will remain nameless. But one of them said to me, it smacks of protesting a little too much. But I think, look, Gary Savage and Mercedes have to say agency's working. It is the PR story. Can't be anything other than this is what customers want, it is working. But actually, if you look at the figures, they are down on sales. At the same time, BMW and Audi are up.
But I would say, James, Mercedes' argument to that is that they're no longer chasing volume, is what they say. They're chasing margin, aren't they?
For me, it's a pure profit play for the OEM, which is fine. You know, as long as the consumer still gets the end price that they're looking for, I think the fixed price piece is interesting. And again, if I go back to used car sector and Imperial, and I mean, Car Giant were great proponents of this, you know, it was fixed price, no haggle, no hassle. You know, but in our market, in the used car market, that is about being probably putting your cars online at 97-98% of market value on AutoTrader, knowing that you're highly competitive. So you can bang that drum. You know, why would we reduce this car, Mr. Customer? If you look on AutoTrader, you'll see it's at a great price. I suppose it's a little bit different in new car sector. And the comparison then is with dealers that haven't gone, or networks that haven't gone down that model, which obviously at the moment Audi and BMW haven't. So there's still that flexibility there. But yeah, I think the whole Mercedes piece is interesting. You're right, James. They're going to have to come out with positive PR. Otherwise, that's the end of that model, isn't it?
And everybody's watching them. That's the thing. I mean, you've got JLR saying they're doing it from the end of next year. Stellantis, Volkswagen Group waiting in the wings with their agency models. Everybody's eyes are focused on Mercedes and how they're performing. So everybody is scrutinizing every single number that comes out of that business. The one that's just keeps getting mentioned to me is the high level of self-registrations they're doing and where they're pushing this stock into daily rental and those other channels rather than retail. And he did answer that question, didn't he? He said, he came back and said, as part of agency, we now provide demonstrators and other showroom vehicles. Therefore, it's only natural that the numbers will have gone up, especially compared to 2022.
How many of those do you have to register in a year? I mean, what's the turnover of demonstrators? You do one every 3 months, 6 months, something like that? I know they do have a lot of models, in fairness, but...
The other point is, we asked him, what do you say to the criticism from customers? And it did feel like he kind of said, you know, what criticism? I certainly haven't seen any. Well, it's not very hard to find it, Gary. You know, you only have to look on your Facebook page. There is a lot of moans on there.
Well, so, I thought that was a bit like in the Philip Schofield interview, just to drag that on for another week. He said something on the lines of, oh, you know, I haven't looked at any of the coverage. I can't look at any of the coverage. I'm thinking, well, you obviously have looked at the coverage because you know it's not positive. That's why you're here not going, oh, everything's great. You know, you're obviously aware of what's happening. It's just because you don't read every news story doesn't mean you're not aware that there's some criticism going on.
No, so, I mean, I think while they, and I agree with Neil, while there are some people out there who prefer it, no haggle, know the price, like buying, you know, the old Apple iPhone analogy, you know what the price is and it's going to be the same everywhere. I do sort of get that. But there's also a lot of people that expect a deal. And I think quite enjoy doing a deal. And if they don't get one, feel like they've been had over. And I think that's the issue the industry is having at the moment, is moving people away from that to this and getting used to fixed prices. And I think that's going to take some time.
The other thing I noticed in this, sorry to interrupt Neil, I was just going to say, he was talking about how they are, since launch, they've made changes and tweaks and they're constantly changing the process. And he said, since it launched, I mean, when did they start this? A year ago?
No, January the 1st.
January the 1st. So since January the 1st, they have made 333 changes to the processes involved in this. And to me, that just shows how complicated it is for manufacturers to start adopting this. So it's all right for them as well. I mean, it's obviously proving complicated enough for them, but they're a behemoth of a company, aren't they? Yes. So it's just, I can see why people like Dale Wyatt at Suzuki just say, no, I don't fancy trying that.
I agree fully. And I think I've been doing a lot of work with some customers recently, and also a relatively new startup in sort of the customer experience space, and looking at customer experience through the whole journey, not just at the point where there's a point of contact or the customer's done the transaction, and then it's about an NPS score, which is obviously a great benchmark, fantastic, but it's quite narrow in its focus. So I think when you start to look at the fact that you've got dealers that aren't now dealers, but you've got customers going into those dealers to look at vehicles, at a point there's a handoff to the whole online agency direct sale piece, isn't there? But there's a disconnect there because, you know, they might get a great service from the dealer, but if that online piece doesn't deliver for them in experientially, and there's points in it that they're thinking, oh my god, I can't be asked with filling this in or doing that or doing this or doing that, so there is a real disconnect there, or potential for a disconnect from that traditional dealer experience, that they'll still get to a point, and then what they're going to experience through that agency direct to consumer piece. And it's difficult to see how they're going to start to sort of merge those two and put them together. So, you know, where is the responsibility now for a lost sale? Does it sit with, does it sit with the dealer because they didn't give the customer a great experience when they walked in? Does it sit with the agency, sit with the OEM because they didn't give a great experience? And that's probably to your point, John. They've been making lots and lots of tweaks, which you would anticipate they've got to do because they've got to get that journey right. And if there's any point in that journey where a customer's looking to spend £40,000 on a new Mercedes that suddenly spooks them, then that's a problem, because how do you rescue that?
Yes.
You know, what is the level of team they've got at the OEM level that is going to then contact their customer and say, oh, I saw you left the journey at the point that we gave you a part exchange valuation or whatever. You know, where's the responsibility for that? And maybe some of what we're seeing in the sales figures is down to them trying to get that piece right.
Because
the marketing must still be delivering the same amount of people in at the top of the funnel. What's happening is not as many are going through the funnel to transaction.
It's not going to be an easy thing, is it? I think just one of his other points in this is Jim asked him, how long should we wait before judging agency? And he said, certainly not yet, were his comments. It's true, January and February were nowhere near in terms of sales numbers, he's talking. It did take time to build momentum despite all the good work we did to prepare. And Jim also asked him, when do you think the scrutiny on this is going to stop? And he says, I don't feel under scrutiny. I get that it is inevitable that the press will look at us, and I guess that will be less prevalent as others follow suit. But ultimately, this is our approach and we will see it through, he said. Very, very, very interesting piece. Both of those from Jim Holder. If you haven't read them, I urge you to go on the website and go and have a read of them, because they are very, very telling. Right, shall I move on, John, to my one?
No.
I will, thank you. And I'm going to go with the aforementioned Motorpoint results for their last financial year, which were frankly woeful. So they Motorpoint announced a £300,000 loss for the year ending March the 31st. They've swung from a record £21.5 million profit the year before to this £300,000 loss, which is why these results are so stark. Directors said in their announcement to the London Stock Exchange earlier this week that this was due to limited stock availability. The well-documented fall in value of electric vehicles, they said, was also partially to blame, as well as pointing the finger at rising financing costs. Some of that I don't quite buy. I mean, this limited stock availability is something that's impacted across the industry, and I will come to Neil in a moment and ask his opinion on this, but everybody could see that coming. 2020, we sold a lot less cars. Guess what? 2023, there's a lot less used cars available. So, I mean, that is a worry. If they didn't see that coming, for me, that really is a concern. They've said as part of these results, they're going to halt the rollout of new stores. So they have been investing in those quite heavily over the last couple of years. They did sell less cars in the last year. They said, obviously, as a result of the fact there was less around, dropped from 97,700 it sold in 2022 to just shy of 90,000. But the point on this I'm going to make is there was a follow up story that we wrote, which came from Zeus Capital. This was a briefing note that they put out to investors following those shock results. And they actually warned that there were more losses to come. Zeus Capital's note was sent out to investors the day afterwards, and it analysed those results in detail. Shares fell dramatically as a result of those results. I've just checked again; they're down 10% now this week. They've dropped 44% in the past 12 months. Those shares. And the note from Zeus Capital said, in our view, Motorpoint has a strong brand, good customer loyalty, growing market share in 0 to 4 year old vehicles, and a well invested technology platform. That said, we think Motorpoint shares are overvalued based on forecast fundamentals and macroeconomic conditions. Motorpoint is expensive in relative terms, they said, even when looking 3 years out. We think the franchise motor retailers, this was the interesting point, offer better cash generation potential, profitability and value. So as a result of that, they switched its estimate for 2024 from a £400,000 profit to a whopping £3.2 million loss for this next financial year. And it doesn't think it's going to tip back into profit until 2025. And it's reduced its estimate for that year too. So some damning comments there from Zeus Capital, a very, very well-regarded industry analyst and broker. So, yeah, I think shocking news, really, from Motorpoint. We were expecting it. They had made some warnings that their numbers were going to be down, but we didn't expect them to be this bad. Neil, I'll be fascinated to hear your opinion on this. Were you surprised when you saw this?
Yeah, I was. Yeah, look, I've obviously, back in the Imperial days, watched the likes of Motorpoint very closely. Weren't really a competitor in our market directly. We were focused on 3 to 4 year old cars. They were very much that 0 to 12 month. I think when we started to see the EV debacle early this year, I went on to a lot of the major sites and just looked at the sort of percentage of stock those sites were holding. Mm-hmm. I think if I remember rightly, Motorpoint would probably been around about 10%, which was about the maximum I saw across some of those volume retailers. So that's obviously had an impact, but that would have that's not delivered that type of swing. I think to your point around that stock availability, 2021-22, 2.2 million less new cars sold than previous to that. So everybody knew what was coming, everybody. And a lot of the guys I deal with sort of made or mitigated that by spinning up their own car buying services and really pushing money into those, looking at different channels, which were your motorway and your maybe your car whales and that have spun up. Now, again, those channels aren't going to work for Motorpoint when they're focusing on sort of 0 to 6 to 12 month stock. So they could have, they would definitely have seen a real impact because those cars were not coming back through from the new sales. So
they've thrived in recent years, haven't they, on pre-registration stock, on those cars that have been pushed into dealers and then rapidly sold out. So, and obviously that's disappeared with the shortage of new cars coming. Do you think this is what's hit them the hardest and that's why we're seeing such devastating numbers?
Yeah, I do. And I, you know, again, I'll go back to a previous comment I made operating in the volume use market sector. It's a bloody roller coaster ride, okay? So used vehicle sector, you've got to be on it all the time. The guys at Motorpoint are on it. Maybe they weren't able to react quick enough to look at the model of or the profile of stock they were retailing. Well,
that's it. Surely you change what you're selling. If there's stuff
And look, we used to flip this around all the time at Imperial. And don't get me wrong, we did not always make the right decision. So we would track market. Sometimes stock sub 10K was worth having because it was moving very fast and we could get the stock that we needed, then that wouldn't be available. So we'd have to flip to 15 to 20K stock and we'd always be looking at changing. You know, on average, we'd retail stock at 14.5 grand. It'd be high spec stock and it would be 3 to 4 year old. We'd go with some part exchanges up to sort of 7 years old, 70,000 miles. But we were constantly looking at that stock mix. Now, I think where Motorpoint have had a problem is they were 100% on that pre-reg 6 month to a year old X rental, X daily rental, very little prep needed. You know, once you start going into your 3 to 4 year stock, you're starting to ramp up prep bills then. Mm. So not only, you know, if you're going for pre-reg, your prep cost might be 150 quid. If you're going for 3 to 4 year old stock, you get into your 550, 600 quid. And if you're not used to spending that's a significant cost that starts to impact on your bottom line as well. So if you start to extend the age of vehicles you're going to stock, there's associated costs that come in against that, which you need to accommodate for. So, look, I don't know the guys at Motorpoint well enough to know what's happened, but yeah, it was shocking news because I've known them well enough to know that they've built a good business and generated good profits over the years.
Did you buy those excuses that they've labelled as the reason for a 21 million pound swing in profit? Or do you think there's something else?
No, I can imagine that having not had accessibility to that low cost of prep, easy to turn, quick to turn stock, because don't forget also, if you haven't got to prep those cars, you are adding 10 days or reducing your days to turn by 10 days, so you can really cycle your money well. So when you start to look at that, and if you're selling, you know, for us, we were selling 20,000 cars a year. So if we could have got our prep down to 150 quid and been 600 quid, we'd have made shed loads of money. But go the other way, and you're suddenly seeing those cars costing you £500 to £600. If you've got to go further down that value chain, then that can have an impact. EV, depending on the hits they took, that would have been a big hit. You know, I know dealers a few days after that first Tesla reduction, they were binning out of cars, EV cars, e-Golfs at £5,000 below what they bought the things for.
Well, they do see, I will say, they seem to have got rid of all that stock if they do have any, because I had a look before this podcast. They've got like 5,000 cars in stock, 120 or something are EV. I mean, that is a low percentage, isn't it?
Really? Clearly had their fingers burned, didn't they?
Yeah.
They're dead right. They weren't alone. I think a lot of the retailers I deal with may have had 2% maximum stock would be EV. Obviously, in the profile of stock they were selling, they would have had a lot of EV, and I'm pretty certain it probably was around that sort of 10% mark. So, and what you've got to do then is you've got to divest as quickly as possible, because that story, as we've seen over the last few months, only gets worse to a point where it stabilizes. And if you're going to be taking hits on some of that stock of £5,000 and you've got 500 of them, that is a real detriment to your bottom line. So I don't materially disagree with the reasons. I think now, for them and like us at Imperial, every now and again we just had to sit down and review what we were selling and what we need, and we needed to buy volume, they need to buy volume, so you need to go where the volume is, and you've got to then go where the volume is and using data available from the aggregators what sells best at the time and what the best days to turn are and what the best days to sell are, and if you're constantly on that, then you should be able to, you know, minimize the impact of those sort of changes. But I think the EV piece would have been massive for them, and I think the lack of stock they're referring to will be in that sort of profile of stock that they are traditionally selling.
I wouldn't be surprised if this leads to a bid from somebody. I wouldn't be surprised if the next thing we start hearing is that talk of an acquisition. But
you heard it here first.
We will see. Right, John, over to you.
Okay, it's a very business heavy podcast we've got today, but I'm gonna talk about Pendragon. There's been some fallout from OD Asset Management, which of course is Crispin.
Be careful what you say here, Jonathan.
Well, he's been accused of sexual misconduct, hasn't
he? He denies.
Mr. OD. But they seem to be, despite this, there seems to be some movement going on there. So they do own a chunk of Pendragon. This is his asset management company, but they've offloaded 5%. Apparently the shares will be bought by a mix of new and existing investors, but we don't know who that will be. What I'm interested in is who is going to sweep in and nick a bit of Pendragon. Does it leave the door open to you know who?
It's funny you should say that, John, because I looked at this morning. There was a lot of shares sold yesterday. I mean, it was something like 94 million shares were sold yesterday. So I am equally fascinated to see who snapped those up, because it just won't be traditional investors. It will be some big organization that's done it. And they're going to have to show their hand. And once they get to 3%, they have to declare it. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next coming days, won't it?
Certainly.
I saw when this story came out about OD selling off these large proportion of shares in a number of different businesses. They sold some earlier this week that Fraser's snapped up, and the Times has been running stories all week. And I knew that OD had about 10% of Pendragon, so I was wondering when this was going to happen. And the share price did take a bit of a dip. You can't put all these shares into the market at the same time, because it does crash the share price, doesn't it? So it will be interesting to see where that deal's been done, and whether it is one of these businesses that we know that are quite acquisitive. You know, I mean, I'm talking about Constellation. You know, have they snapped up some of these shares?
Or have Hedin popped their heads back over the? Well, I think they want to.
The issue with Hedin is they already own a large proportion. I'm pretty sure it's about 25 or 27%. And if you go over 30%, you have to make an offer for the business, you know. So I think they might be holding back as a result. I'm sure that Hedin will come back to the table very, very shortly. With an offer for Pendragon. If you remember, there was that story about that litigation, which I'm pretty sure is still ongoing with Pinewood, which is sort of rumbling away in the background. I'm not sure at what state that they haven't announced whether that has been settled, So it will be interesting to see what happens if, when that is settled, whether Heading come back with an offer. The other thing is, in a couple of weeks' time, Pendragon have got their AGM, so be wondering what they put out as a result of that. So, yeah, an interesting one, that, John.
Thank
you. Shall I pick one?
Do, because we're running out of time. Perhaps it, if it's your final one, not to
agree,
James.
Let me
I do want some lunch.
Let me squeeze one in. And it's about another used car dealer. This is the Trade Center Group this time. Their results for last year, seeing profits plummet, and they're blaming the cost of living crisis. They saw profits for their last financial year fall 62%. So that was a fall from 18.6 million in 2021 to 6.9 million in 2022. This is a group that's got dealerships across the country. They trade in Wales as a Trade Centre Wales, which is a very well-known brand, Neath and Cardiff. But they've also got sites in England, Coventry, Rochdale, Rotherham, Wednesbury and Birmingham are the sites that they're running. They actually did sell more used cars. So conversely to Motorpoint, who sold less, they actually sold more last year, up to 41,000. Their turnover increased as well to £345 million, up from £258 million the year before. But as a result of the inflationary pressures and that cost of living crisis, they've seen their profits fall. The other interesting point that's happened here is Mark Bailey, the founder, is now back in the chairman role. Andy Coulthurst, who used to work for motors.co.uk and has been in that role for quite some time, is now, I think he moved up to chairman. He's now back as chief executive after a board reshuffle in September. And they say that they are confident that they can get those numbers back up. But interesting to see another used car dealer announcing a fall in profits compared to some of the other business stories that we've been running and financial results for franchise dealers. I mean, for example, one of them was Hartwell results this week, which actually showed profits up last year. So interesting to see the franchise dealers doing better than the used car dealers here.
It does say as well, they reprofiled their range of cars that they stock. And the total value it held went from 50 million in 2021 to 41 million last year. Yes. So that sounds a little bit like they are going down the market in terms of maybe they're adjusting in terms of people can afford less, give them slightly cheaper, older cars. Is that seems to be where it's possibly going?
Do you know what I thought when I read this story, the Motorpoint one especially, and this Trade Centre Group? I was really surprised about the Trade Centre Group. Mm. I thought, well, if these two guys can't get it right, what's going to happen to Cazoo as a result? Because they haven't made money in the good times. So if the bad time, if they can't make money in the good times, what's going to happen in the bad times? What did you think about these Trade Center Group results, Neil? Were you surprised by those as well?
Do you know what? Less surprised, I think, than Motorpoint. And the reason for that is, I think, and I know Andy, and I've known him since Motors days, that model of vehicle retailing is legacy and tired. It's not digital. You know, if you go onto their website, they don't surface any stock. There's nothing for consumers to look at. It's like a 1980s full page spread in a newspaper. So that may have worked for the past few years, but I think as we are now seeing that digitally enabled, savvy digital adopter consumer, My feeling is that they've suddenly started to realize that the consumer now has much more access to pricing information. So they're a little more savvy when arriving at site, and they're having to either go down that value chain, or they're having to discount more, or they're having to reduce their prices. Mm. And that's why I think this is different at the Motorpoint. I think it is basically that the model is no longer really totally fit for purpose in this digital age. And they probably got to start looking at how they're retailing cars and how they're advertising cars and how they're marketing cars and start to appeal a little more to that digital market.
Because it's always been about with them getting people into the showroom, isn't it? In that traditional kind of, sausage meat factory style of getting people through the system. But it's worked in the past, though. I mean, if you rewind a couple of years back, they actually were the most profitable in the car dealer top 100, most profitable independent dealer with very, totally. Very healthy profits.
Totally. But I think the point they alluded to is probably actually driving that behavior now, that the fact of the matter is cost of living has increased. So consumers are making sure they're getting the best deal they can. And they're doing that research even more so now. And if you're in a business where you can't, if I'm buying a car and I go on a website and I can't see any stock, I'm off of that website.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, I don't care whether it says you can buy this car for £25 a month. Well, £25 a week. That's not for me. I want to see the car I want to purchase. I want to see all about the spec. I don't want to have to travel to a site. So that model is going to reduce over time as more and more people grow up digitally enabled, digitally savvy, and want to buy cars in a hybrid way. I mean, Converse, that is the exact opposite to Cazoo. So they only offer, Trade Center only offer the traditional market, Cazoo only offer the online. In the middle are all these dealers who are doing some great things that are omnichannel. That's my view. The ones that are omnichannel have got the better chance. They're addressing all of those different market sectors. You know, there's three types of buyers Auto Trader put out last year. Digital adopters, which are pure online. Reluctant showroom visitors, who are the visitors to showrooms which still see value in it but want to do a lot of the journey online. And proactive showroom visitors, which are the ones who are quite happy to go to the showroom. So obviously Cazoo attract digital adopters and Trade Center Wales attracts reluctant proactive showroom visitors, those that are happy to go and do that journey. In the middle, there's a massive swathe of people who want that hybrid piece.
It will certainly be interesting to see if they do change their model over the next couple of years and whether these predictions come true.
Well, Mark, Andy, if you're listening, you can contact Neil on LinkedIn. unless he's in Croatia on a beach. Neil, just so you know, we do charge a 10% agency. Well,
I'm happy to advise and consult for anyone, John.
John, was that our agency model you just announced?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
Direct to business. Yeah.
Yeah, it's got a 4.7 out of 5 customer satisfaction rating, actually. So I can point to that as a success.
Yeah, successful. Yeah.
Right. Is that the end of our stories?
Yes.
Neil, are there any stories you think we've missed?
No, I don't actually. No, I think you've covered the main ones. And I suppose my final point is something you picked up on a minute ago, James. You know, the franchise dealer networks have had some great times over the last year. For me, that's because they've had to turn their attention to used vehicle retailing because the new stock's not been there, and they've actually got it right now. You know, years ago it was all new and they weren't brilliant at retailing used, and used car supermarkets definitely had a big advantage and used car volume retailers. Right now, used car volume retailers are having to compete with franchise dealer networks that have realized how to sell used cars.
Mm. Yeah.
Because they've had to. And they've had the backup and the support of the franchise at the OEMs and getting through a time when, you know, it was pretty dire in 2020 with no new stock to sell. They had to do something and they've done it and they've reacted brilliantly and they've changed, to some extent, they changed their model. You know, they're far more focused on that used car retailing. But that can be, and one of the areas that I've seen within franchise that really supports the used car sector is obviously buying a new car. That franchise brings in a bloody good quality 2 to 3 year old used car. Mm. And that delivers them way better profit than if you're going out as a used car retailer and buying from auction.
Yeah, I mean it's the jewel in the crown in some respects, isn't it? Yeah. No acquisition cost. You can buy if you can buy at the right price. Often that person doesn't go anywhere else. You can see why that is a really important part of dealers' businesses.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Neil.
So Neil, I'm going to have to ask: who do you think chose the best stories? Who has won?
Well, do you know what? I'm going to go with James. Sorry, John, because I still liked his coffee story.
What more? That was probably the best one. Well, I won't be doing after dinner speaking anytime soon.
Oh, thanks, Neil. Much appreciated. I'm glad you support my too hot coffee campaign.
100%, James. You don't want to. You don't want to burn the milk, and you don't want to burn the beans, mate. That's the two.
Utter nonsense.
I'm gonna play this back to John every time he brings up this story, which is quite often.
Brilliant.
It's true.
All right, guys.
Well, lovely to have you on, Neil. Thanks for joining us. And thank you also to James for putting up with me making fun of him again. Well, thank you for listening as well. We'll be back next week with another episode, so make sure you're subscribed so you can be notified when that goes live. If you're listening on Spotify, don't forget you can swipe up now and vote on whether the coffee should have gone back or not. If you want to check out the stories we mentioned today, you can click the links in the show notes below or head to cardealermagazine.co.uk, where you'll find those and much more news besides. Thanks again. Until next time, goodbye.